Hi, I'm Moji Alawodeyau from the Feminist Buzzkills Live Pod, the only podcast that helps you navigate the news in this post-pro anti-abortion hellscape. Each week, with co-host Liz Winstead, we dissect all the news from that sketchy intersection of abortion and misogyny with providers and activists working on the ground. The cherry on top is we have amazing comedy guests who help us laugh through the rage. Feminist Buzzkills Live drops Fridays wherever you pod. Listen and subscribe, because when BS is popping, we pop off.
It's no surprise that newsmakers try to manipulate the audience. They want you to believe that they are the one holding the line, and they'll use any trick they can to get you there. But don't let them fool you. Get unspun. I'm Amanda Sturgill. I've been a reporter, and today I teach future reporters to cut the spin and think critically about what newsmakers say. My podcast, Unspun, shows you how to know when you're being manipulated by the news. Learn to spot the tricks and how to make up your own mind about what's true. So if you're tired of being fooled by the news, subscribe to Unspun today. Unspun, because you deserve the truth.
Our press secretary gave alternative facts to that.
My goal in this deposition was to be truthful, but not particularly helpful.
Welcome to Unspun, the podcast that makes you better at finding the truth. The way people get news is changing. It used to be that there were many reporters who would research stories and write articles, but now politicians and famous people share information directly with you on social media and the internet. That means you find out things fast, but it's up to you to make sure the information's actually accurate. And newsmakers don't always do their part. The temptation to manipulate information is strong. They bend the truth to deceive so that they can avoid accountability, so that they can advance their agendas. When you recognize these agendas, you can sometimes find out what's real. And we're at a crossroads where anyone can share anything online, so it's important to sharpen your critical thinking skills. Finding that deception before it goes viral is pretty much a survival skill now, and we're going to do it together. Let's get unspun.
I think no personal injury, Mr. Cole.
No, sir.
And if I did, I beg your pardon. Let us not assassinate this land further, Senator. Let you have done and done. Have you no sense of decency, sir, at long last?
You just heard a famous moment in history when the tide turned against Senator Joseph McCarthy during a hearing where he was taking on the U.S. Army with accusations of harboring communists. McCarthy is, of course, well known, but the interesting bit, I think, is the other voice that you hear. McCarthy, a name synonymous with fear and paranoia, was a real master of the dramatic. He used his booming voice and his theatrical pronouncements to accuse anyone he thought was a communist, usually without evidence. But it was during this televised Senate hearing in 1954 that McCarthy's tactics backfired. He was attacking the U.S. Army, claiming they were harboring communists and that the entire nation was watching. On the other side of the table sat Joseph Welch, a lawyer who was defending the Army. As McCarthy launched into a tirade against a young lawyer named Fred Fisher, accusing him of being a communist, Welch had had it. He stood up, his voice shaking with emotion, and you heard him say, "Until this moment, Senator, I think I never really gauged your cruelty or your recklessness." He went on, "Let us not assassinate this lad further, Senator. You've done enough. Have you no sense of decency, sir? At long last, have you no sense of decency?" Fisher was a young lawyer who was just doing his job defending the Army, and he was caught in McCarthy's crosshairs. He wasn't actually accused of being a communist himself, but McCarthy used his association with a case involving a private contractor, Irving Peres, who had been accused of being a communist, to attack Fisher. McCarthy's accusations were unfounded. It was a tactic to further his own agenda of fear and suspicion, but it was devastating for Fisher. The moment Welch challenged McCarthy, asking him if he had any decency, became a real turning point in the McCarthy era. It was a powerful moment of resistance against fear and injustice, and it helped to bring down McCarthy. Welch's technique that really turned the attitude of the country away from McCarthy was to use an appeal to emotion. You know that question, "Have you no sense of decency?" It was more than just a rhetorical question. It was a direct assault on McCarthy's character and a call to the audience's sense of fairness. Welch, who was known for his calm demeanor, was visibly shaken by McCarthy's relentless attacks on Fisher. By appealing to McCarthy's sense of decency, Welch was not only challenging his actions, but also calling upon the audience to recognize the cruelty and recklessness of McCarthy's tactics. That question, have you no sense of decency, it resonated with the American public because they were kind of getting tired of McCarthy's fear-mongering. That appeal to emotion is a logical fallacy where someone tries to persuade other people by appealing to their emotions rather than using reason or evidence. It's a fallacy that manipulates people's feelings to make them believe something, even if it's not logically sound. So imagine a news report about a murder trial, and maybe the reporter uses graphic descriptions of the victim's injuries, or they play emotional music in the background, or they interview grieving family members who say how angry they are and how much they want justice. This kind of emotional manipulation tries to make viewers feel sympathy for the victim and anger toward the defendant, even if the evidence presented in the case is not conclusive. So here's another example.
What is it about this story that has gripped America, do you think?
Well, Pierce, that's an excellent question, and a lot of people have wondered about that, and I think it boils down to something very simple. The little girl you see on the screen, there's something about Kelly herself, her smile, her persona. We see her in video. We hear her voice. A lot of times when children go missing, we don't have the photos or the videos to really get to know them. And also, Pierce, I believe that when you look at Tot Mom, Casey Anthony, it's almost as if the mind is tricking the eye because you hear this damning evidence about her and you look at her in court. She's a sweet looking petite. She looks pale and frail with her hair back in a ponytail like a cheerleader. And it's hard to take in and assimilate that what you're seeing is not what the evidence is telling you.
I mean, given all your experience with these kind of things, Nancy, do you think there's much doubt that she was responsible for the death of her daughter?
Well, in my mind, based on the evidence that I have heard, and I've still got to hear the rest, the defense may surprise me, but the fact that she lied for 31 days after her daughter goes missing, and now we hear an opening statement, she's saying her father is the one that disposed of his little granddaughter's body. And by all accounts, Pierce, Kelly was the love of George and Cindy's life.
That voice is Nancy Grace, who is a personality on CNN, and she's talking during the trial of Casey Anthony. Casey Anthony was a Florida mother who was charged with killing her young daughter, Kaylee. Casey Anthony was actually acquitted of that murder. She was found not guilty. But if you listen to Grace's words, she's appealing to emotion as well. Maybe you could even hear the air quotes around goes missing. You can see them in the video as Grace is transferring her tone of incredulity to the viewers. Now, it might seem to you that strong emotions is a good way to get justice. Because after all, feelings like empathy and anger can make us act. But relying only on emotions can actually get in the way. First, trying to make people feel something can make them ignore facts. People might exaggerate details, pick and choose what information to share, or tell a story in a way that makes people feel a certain way. That can make it hard to understand what really happened and make it difficult to be fair. And you know, second, emotions can cloud your judgment. People make decisions based on how they feel instead of thinking things through. And if a jury feels really bad for a victim's family, for example, they might not think about other things that matter to the person who's actually defending. And then trying to make people feel something can make them think in terms of us versus them. And that makes it really hard because it's a powerful and it's really a dangerous tool that sometimes shows up in news coverage, particularly when you're dealing with controversial or divisive topics like court cases. It takes complex issues and it simplifies them. It divides people into two groups, the good guys and the bad guys, and it just ignores all those nuances and complexities of a story, kind of overlooking those gray areas, and it plays on those existing biases and prejudices. For example, a news report might portray a defendant as a monster to evoke fear and disgust, while portraying the victim as a saint to evoke sympathy and outrage. This creates a sense of us, you know, everyone who shares the same values, and them, those who are different or opposing. And it makes it difficult to approach issues with objectivity. People are more likely to support their in-group and to dismiss people in that out-group, even if the people in the out-group have a really valid perspective. And what's really bad is that it can lead to a rush to judgment and a disregard for due process. People might be more likely to believe accusations against the out-group without considering evidence or even giving the accused a fair chance to defend themselves. I think you see this sometimes in social media mobbing, where you'll see a video of someone and people will just decide that they've done this terrible thing and sometimes try to look them up and embarrass them and ruin their lives and those kind of things. When people think a justice is about emotions instead of facts and evidence, they might lose their trust in the legal system itself. And when people get cynical like this and think the system's unfair, it just gets worse when you try to get justice for people. So, you know, emotions are important, but they shouldn't be the only thing that guide the search for justice. And it's important to say that it's not all outrage. You can use positive emotions to manipulate people, too. So, for example, defense attorneys can use empathetic language to encourage a jury to fail to convict. You know, they might emphasize, for example, that the perpetrator feels really sorry for the crime. In a recent case in Trinidad and Tobago, a U.S. citizen broke a law by having ammunition, but the judge gave him a suspended sentence because the defense attorney argued that there was possible impact on his two young children. Positive or negative, appealing to emotion is a way to manipulate, and in fact, it's one of the fundamental strategies of communication. And when the media get involved and magnify this, it makes it really difficult. I have to take a quick break, but when I return, we'll hear my uninterrupted interview with Asha Rangappa and Renato Mariotti, two of my fellow podcasters in the MSW Media Network who are experts in the justice system. I'll be right back. Welcome back. My guests this week are Asha Rangappa and Renato Mariotti. Asha Rangappa has been a special agent in the New York division of the FBI, and she specialized in counterintelligence investigations. And she's also taught national security law at Yale, Wesleyan, University of New Haven. She publishes op-eds in the New York Times, The Atlantic, The Washington Post. She's appeared on NPR, the BBC, major television networks, and she's a legal and national security analyst for CNN. Renato Mariotti has worked as an attorney and a federal prosecutor, and he's investigated and prosecuted hundreds of cases in areas like child exploitation, human trafficking, and public corruption. Then he returned to private practice in 2016, and he's a frequent legal contributor on CNN and MSNBC. Asha and Renato, welcome to Unspun.
Okay, so one of the things that I'm really curious about, and I think my listeners are too, is what are some of the ways that news coverage can actually affect a trial?
So I'd say a couple different ways. One is that it can impact jurors. It can impact jury selection, and then it can impact the people who ultimately end up on the jury. If there's been news coverage before a trial begins, then that means that you're going to have people in the jury pool who are going to say that they can't be fair, or they've already formed impressions of the people involved in the case. News coverage in the midst of the trial can potentially influence jurors if they inadvertently view that news coverage. So that's an issue as well. But you know, news coverage, you know, can also create a circus around the trial and create a situation where, for example, there's media in the courtroom, and potentially generate press attention that brings people out of the woodwork that can be witnesses at the trial as well.
Oh, okay. So there can be positive and negative effects.
Potentially. Usually it's considered negative because from the perspective of a judge who's trying to get through a trial in a fair fashion.
Okay. So one of the things we've been talking about a lot, I think, in the news lately is the idea of gag orders. Can you explain sort of what that is exactly and why you might want one or not want one, I guess?
Yes, well, if we look at in the context of Trump's case, you know, it's an extraordinary remedy, right? Because obviously we place a premium on First Amendment rights, the ability for defendants in particular to be able to, you know, express themselves, especially on political matters. And so the bar is really high. I mean, there has to be some way in which the possible speech will affect the integrity of the actual court proceedings. And I think that's what's at play here in the Trump cases. With even there, you know, we see that the judges that have put these things in place have made them very narrowly tailored to apply to certain things while still giving quite wide berth. But just to dovetail on what Renato said about news coverage, I think that these two things intersect, right? Because the news coverage effectively becomes a way for the types of comments that these gag orders are trying to suppress get amplified. We saw this yesterday, for example, when basically Trump brought in surrogates to say all the stuff that he can't say. And then the news media, you know, was covering it all and, you know, amplifying it. You see all these clips on social media, et cetera. So I think one thing to say about the news coverage is that it can help circumvent some of the purposes of the gag order as they apply in this case.
I know that one of the things that people have been complaining about with the gag order is that it's a First Amendment violation. Is that a concern?
Absolutely. In fact, gag orders are very intensely litigated. And news organizations routinely oppose gag orders, and there's a reason why. In the United States, there's a presumption that people can speak and that the government can't stop them from speaking, particularly beforehand. That's something called a prior restraint on speech. And that's exactly what a gag order is. It is the government, in this case, a judge of court, court is a government entity, saying in advance, you, this specific individual, you cannot say what you would like to say.
So clearly it happens sometimes, right, that people say things and it might like affect the outcome of a trial. As an attorney, do you plan for that? Do you plan for, you know, news coverage when you're sort of plotting out how the trial is going to go?
Yes. And how much you plan for news coverage depends on the case. Okay. First of all, some cases are more noteworthy than others. For clients, speaking as somebody who represents clients around the country who are at times going to trial, for some clients, news coverage is an important goal. So as an attorney, I'm always considering, what are my clients' goals? In a criminal context, criminal trial, obviously an overriding goal is not being convicted of a felony. All right. But even there, if you have broader business at stake, if somebody owns a significant business and they're on trial, another goal is, how does this news coverage impact their business? And so there can be other concerns there as well. But certainly, I mean, there are times when I have civil cases that also generate very significant publicity, and they're shaping that publicity as part of the trial, shaping the narrative, because often you'll have other cases that are related. Sometimes you have a client that has broader goals, and that news coverage serves those goals.
So just in case somebody doesn't know, and I know this is a really basic question, what's the difference between civil and criminal?
Yeah, so civil cases are between private parties, typically. I mean, they can be, you know, between private parties and the government, but they're really about, transgressing some right or duty or obligation that we have towards, you know, someone else. Defamation lawsuits, for example, are an example of this. And when you've harmed someone, it's about, compensating someone for the harm when you breach these duties. Or a contract or something like that.
Okay, I understand. I'd like to switch gears just a little bit. As someone who trains future reporters, I'm curious, do reporters get stuff wrong when they cover trials?
The reporters often get things wrong in legal cases in general. There's some reporters who cover courtrooms for a living. Those reporters do a much better job. So, for example, there's an entity called Law 360, they have reporters in courts, and they'll just sit there in, let's say, a particular court and cover it all the time. You know, I live in Chicago. I know the court's reporter for the Chicago Tribune and the Chicago Sun-Times. And I, you know, interact with them all the time, and they're very good because these are people who are in the courtroom a lot, who are covering a lot of cases. They generally get things right. But a lot of times reporters are just trying to kind of parachute in and cover legal issues. And legal issues can be very complicated. They can have a lot of nuance. And oversimplifying those issues often leads to stories that can mislead the public. So I think that's an issue, but it's often very difficult to deal with if you are somebody who is litigating a case, because ultimately you just have to live with the fact that there are some errors out there.
So from the perspective of the audience, what are some sources that you would, you know, maybe recommend, or reporters that you'd recommend for better coverage of these kind of big national trials that we're seeing right now?
There are a number of good reporters. I mean, I would prefer probably not to just like name a bunch of names. You know, I think anyone though who's on the justice beat, for a major network outlet will typically pick up and get to start know the nuances of the case. I mean, I think the biggest hurdle is sort of that initial learning curve of really understanding what the case is about and the legal issues involved and the jargon and what it means. The best reporters, in my opinion, find experts that can really speak to, you know, the intricacies, you know, as opposed to trying to interpret it on their own. And I think for people who really want to get more into the weeds on some of these things, there are a few outlets. I know Renato and I both write for Just Security, which does like great explainers and kind of breaks down the law in a lot more detail. Lawfare is another similar publication that does that. Renato, do you have any other recommendations?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, as I mentioned before, I think if you're interested in understanding the ins and outs of what's happening in a particular trial, trying to look for reporters who are in the courtroom and are giving you regular updates from the courtroom, I think is very helpful. If you want to understand the details of what's happening, there are reporters who are, you know, out there tweeting constantly about what's happening. I think what you really want to find are reporters who are taking the time to do a deep dive and really understand the legal issues. I think for major publications, like if you're talking about periodicals, I mean, the New York Times and Wall Street Journal reporters, in my experience, have really taken the time to do a deep dive on trials that I have followed. I also think at times Bloomberg and CNBC on business-related trials, like the, for example, the FTX trial, have really gotten in the weeds and tried to do that. But you're looking, you need reporters who aren't just viewing this as like an event, a one-time event. You know, hey, this happened today. I am reporting on this verdict, but actually are taking the time to dive in and understand it.
Okay. So looking for those bylines that you see again and again on those court type stories would probably be a good idea.
That's right.
So I know sometimes you'll see people who are, you know, maybe accused in a criminal trial and they actually go out and talk to the media themselves. You know, from the media perspective, I know the media loves that, right? They'll set up all the little mics for you and ask you a ton of questions and stuff. Is that a good idea for someone who's a, you know, defendant to do that?
I think Renato might be the better person to answer this question. It is generally not a good idea for a defendant to go out and speak to the press during while an investigation or a case is ongoing. You might be familiar with the Miranda warning after someone is arrested, where they say you have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. And the reason that they say that is because anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. And I think often there is a tension between trying to please the court of public opinion and what your interests are in the court of law. You don't want to say things that are contradictory, for example, to things that you, you know, might be a part of your defense. You might not want to confess things that can help the government prove a case against you. There's a number of different pitfalls, but, you know, sometimes I think defendants are so eager to defend themselves in this court of public opinion that they will make that trade-off. But yeah, I would say it's generally a good idea to exercise your right to remain silent.
It's been curious to me since the former president's been on trial for a while now, to see him and his proxies go out and actually attack the credibility of people in the court system, right? Like his judges, court staff, those kind of people. And I don't know that that's a good idea. Do you think it affects the outcome of the case, or what's the likely outcome there of doing that kind of thing?
Well, you don't need me to tell you as somebody who has expertise in this area that attacking the judge is not going to help you get good rulings from the judge in the midst of the trial. I mean, that's common sense, right? However, for someone like Trump, he's not focused entirely on the legal strategy. His goal is not really to win within the four corners of the courtroom. His goal is to create a circus, to try to distract from certain issues that are going on in the courtroom, to attack the integrity of the proceeding, to try to get favorable press coverage, to try to win politically. So for somebody who has goals that are unrelated to winning in a courtroom, it can make sense to talk to the media. I mean, I'll give you another example. Hunter Biden went, you know, to the steps of Congress and basically said, I would be willing to testify, and, you know, gave him a speech and said a bunch of things that he did not have to say. But he was doing that because his real goal is to try to influence public opinion that he believes, and I think rightfully so, has led to an overcharging of his particular case, and he's trying to change that.
Last question, and I'd love to hear an answer from each of you on this. What do you think are some justice in court stories that reporters miss out on that they should be covering and they don't?
Well, I'll take that. You know, I think that there can be a distortion in how we cover courts and the justice system when we look only at very high profile cases. So one thing that I've noticed in the years that I have spent talking to the public about the legal system and the criminal justice system is that there's a wide divergence between the way that most people think about it and how it actually functions. So most people think that it's like a Law and Order episode, that there's a very brief investigation. Maybe the person confesses in the conference room at the prosecutor's office. And then you wheel out in the middle of the trial, which also gets wrapped up very quickly. There's one witness and then a quick verdict. And the reality of the situation is that prosecutors often are overwhelmed and they're trying to keep up with the amount of crime that they are dealing with. Sometimes prosecutors abuse their power and do things that are unfair. And their decision to bring a case can have devastating consequences on someone's family or their business. Sometimes there can be a situation where people are put between a rock and a hard place without a good choice. Often there are trials that are very perfunctory. Often there are cases that drag on for several years. But my point is when you take a focus only on the Sam Bankman-Frieds, the Bill Cosbys, and the Donald Trumps of the world, it offers a distorted picture of what that criminal justice system actually looks like.
Okay, so kind of missing the big picture a little bit by just picking the sort of tall poppies out of the field there. Yeah.
Yeah, and I would say maybe similar to what Renato is mentioning, but maybe in a different context. We talked about civil and criminal cases before. I do think criminal cases tend to get, you know, they're the sexy things. And even in civil context, for example, when we look at the Supreme Court, it's those, you know, obviously really important issues, things like abortion rights, that get a lot of attention. But I think that people don't realize the number of other cases that, for example, the Supreme Court is hearing this term that can significantly impact their day-to-day life, because they're not as sexy in terms of like the facts of the case. Like, it's about like, can the government tell fishermen that they need to pay for the monitors on their fishing boats? But really, this is about, you know, the power of our agencies to be able to ensure compliance and kind of and operationalize a lot of the laws that govern our day-to-day lives. It's much harder to sell that through the news because that's not super exciting. But in many ways, it impacts people much more directly than, say, the high-profile criminal trial of some celebrity.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That's something we always deal with, you know, from a news perspective, is sort of the important stories versus the interesting stories.
Right.
You know, and people click and buy for the interesting stories. And, you know, since media is a business, that becomes a problem. All right. Well, I really appreciate your time today. And I thank you so much for joining me on Unspun.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for getting Unspun with me this week. Unspun is a production of me, Amanda Sturgill, and is a proud member of the MSW Media family of podcasts. Send me your thoughts and ideas about trickery in the news on Gmail at theunspunpodcast@gmail.com. I even write back. And find this episode's show notes and more information at theunspunpodcast.substack.com. Want to learn more and get smarter? Check out my book, Detecting Deception, Tools to Fight Fake News, which is available on Amazon or your favorite online bookseller. And until next time,
Stay sharp, everyone. I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
Hi, I'm Moji Alawodeyal from the Feminist Buzzkills Live Pod, the only podcast that helps you navigate the news in this post-pro anti-abortion hellscape. Each week, with co-host Liz Winstead, we dissect all the news from that sketchy intersection of abortion and misogyny with providers and activists working on the ground. The cherry on top is we have amazing comedy guests who help us laugh through the rage. Feminist Buzzkills Live drops Fridays wherever you pod. Listen and subscribe, because when BS is popping, we pop off.